Hi, this is Carl Reiner, and you are listening to Days Gone By, and are you lucky?
Welcome back, my friends, to the neighborhood. This is one of the greatest thrills of my entire life, ladies and gentlemen, happening right now on the Days Gone By radio show, because we are going to be talking with an absolute living legend in the comedy world. And I've talked to some dead legends, and they were terrible interviews. But this is going to be exciting, because Carl Reiner is on the telephone with me, Rabbi Saul. Now, Carl Reiner has won 12 Emmy Awards. That's more than a million, for God's sakes. He was on Broadway back in 1946 in Call Me Mister. He was in Your Show of Shows on TV. He created the Dick Van Dyke Show, if you can believe it, not to mention playing Alan Brady on there. He directed the great movies The Jerk and All of Me and Oh God and Man with Two Brains. He won the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor, for God's sakes, and he's 91 years old. He's just written another sort of autobiographical book, which you should all go and get. Carl Reiner, bless you and thank you for being in the neighborhood today.
Well, thank you. I hope I can live up to your introduction.
No one can, but it's okay if you don't. I'll smooth over the gaps. So what propelled you, since you have already written autobiographically a few times, everything from the semi-autobiographical novel and play Enter Laugh, well, Joe Stein wrote that, but the novel it was based on was you, and then you've written other biographies of yourself. Why another book about you?
Well, you know, the other little biography I wrote was called My Anecdotal Life, and in it I decided to write just about some of the funny things that happened in my life, and I realized, as I'm walking around the block, stories kept popping into my head. I said, gee, I should have put that down in the original book. And by the time I had 20 stories, I said, I got to put these down. And I titled it, I Remember Me. I was remembering myself as I walked around. Every time I got to a certain corner, I said, oh my God, that thing about my father and his tooth, I got to put that down. And now the interesting thing is, I Remember Me is finished. It's 300 pages. It got about, I don't know, 30, 70, 50 chapters, some short, some long. But as I finished it, and it went to print, and people started buying it, I'm still walking around the block. And this morning,
yes, another story popped into your head, right?
Well, I have now 12 more stories I must tell, and so I'm just starting another book called I Just Remembered.
Would you mind telling us one of the stories that's not even in this book that everybody's going to buy? Well, what's a new story that just occurred to you?
Oh, well, you know, one of the stories that occurred to me is about a guy who was the soul. I better not tell it, because I'm not even sure I'm going to put it in. It's about somebody I know, and it's not flattering, but it is so funny that I'm tortured about.
Well, you can also change the name to protect the innocent. In the book that you wrote, you name names, which I think is always a little more interesting. But if you feel uncomfortable because you still know this person, they're alive and walking around, just call them Chaim Yankel.
No, but my father once told me an interesting thing when you asked me to tell a story that's going to be in the new book. He used to say in Yiddish to me, Zeig nicht ein Narr halb Arbeit. Now, I'm not calling you a narr. He's don't show a fool half work. In other words, while you're working on something, my father was an inventor, and once in a while I'd walk in on him, and he put something in a drawer and close it quickly. And I said, what are you doing, Pa? He says, and I said, tell me. He says, no. And then he said, his father used to tell him, Zeig nicht ein Narr halb Arbeit. And so, now I'm not calling you a narr. You are not a narr. You are Solomon, the voice of sanity and reason and intelligence. But no, I'd rather tell you about the things that are in I Remember Me.
Okay.
I'd rather talk about those.
Sure. Well, no problem with that. And thank you, by the way, for calling me the wisdom and the namesake of Solomon the King. But let me ask, since you bring up your father so often, the amazing story that you even just mentioned about his tooth. I read that. I could barely read it. Please share that with people who hopefully are not having breakfast or lunch while you're telling this.
Okay. My father was a stoic. By the way, a 5'3" stoic. My brother and I were 6'1" and 6'1.5", and my mother and father were 5'2" and 5'3" respectively. And I used to ask my father. I say, Pa, where did we get our height from? Well, he fed us cut liver oil and stamina bread when we were kids to make us grow. But I said, that didn't do it. He says, well, he says, not only the food, he says, but you not only get your genes from us, you have forebears, you have grandfathers. Your height comes from, from earlier on. I said, well, where does the height come from? He says, well, my father was tall. I says, how tall was Grandpa? He says, I never met him. He was in Europe. He said, he was 5'6½".
Oh, my God.
That was tall. Anyway, my father, when I call him a stoic, he was the kind of guy who never cursed. He never said the word shit or fuck or screw. Nothing. Never used a word like that. But I remember once he's sitting at his desk. By the way, he worked in the house. So I saw my father every day of my young life until I went to the Army. I lived in the same house. And where he worked at the window overlooking a schoolyard. And one day I hear, and this is the sound of a stoic being hurt. I heard tisk tisk, if I spell it, but that's all I heard. I looked up and I saw he had a screwdriver going through the fleshy part of his forehead. He had slipped when he's trying to put a screw into a little hole. It slipped and it went right through his finger, and I heard. And I said, Pa, pull it out. He said, no, you don't pull it out. He said, if I pull it out, the blade will rip more of the flesh. So what he did was cut the bottom of the screwdriver off with a clipper that he had, a steel clipper, and pulled it out the other way. Bandaged it, never said a word, went right back to work with a Band-Aid on. But I was saying about my father being a stoic, the one story that I love, I'm sitting there, 13 years old, reading the Bronx Daily News, and he's working, and I hear him go, and I said, I look up, I know something happened, and he's holding something in his thumb and forefinger. He says, look at that. He says, that silver filling has been in my mouth for 35 years. It just fell out.
He says, only those, I hope he didn't put that back in himself.
Oh, he said, I said, Pa, how do you know how long a filling's been in your mouth? And he said, well, this filling, I put it myself. I said, wait a minute, are you telling me you filled your own tooth? And he told me the story. He was about 17 or 18 years old. He was a master watchmaker at 14. At 14, he left home, went to Vienna from Czernowitz in Austria-Hungary, and he had two bad teeth that were bothering him, two molars. He took himself to a dentist. The dentist filled one tooth, not using any Novocaine or anything. He said it was the most excruciating pain he's ever had. He said he paid the guy and ran from the chair. He said, I don't want him to finish the other tooth. And then he said, I have a drill. I am a watchmaker. He went to the library, got a book on dentistry, found out how to make facets, how to drill holes. He found another book on amalgams, how to make silver and mercury into a filling. And he drilled. He says, when I drilled, if it hurt, I stopped. He says, and it took me a little longer than it would have taken him. But he says, I filled my tooth. And he says, there it is, 35, 36 years. And then he did say, he's 40 would have been better. But 36 years, that filling was his own filling.
How long were your parents with you? At what point did you lose them?
My father lived to be 80. My mother passed away first at 73, and my father lived to be about 82, and many years ago.
But they did live to see your great success, and then...
Oh, they saw my success. Oh, yeah, they used to quell. My mother was my biggest fan. My mother was illiterate, and she never let on. My brother and I were about 14 or 15 years old, and we once said, I don't think Mom can read. Because every time there was something to read, she would say, I don't have my glasses, read it to me, if there was something in the newspaper we were trying to show her. Well, but the thing is, when I started doing well on the show of shows, or even when I did Call Me Mister on the road, and New York, and I did these Broadway shows, I'd send her the reviews, and there were some awfully nice reviews, and she'd keep them in a pocketbook, and she'd go to the Crotona Park in the Bronx and sit with her friends and show them these reviews. And she wouldn't read them, but she showed them. And I remember once this is lovely sad, when I wrote my first novel, Enter Laughing, a fictional version of myself becoming an actor, and I sent it to my mother and father, and my mother called and she said, the book is wonderful, we enjoyed it so much, and I knew she couldn't read. I said, yeah, how did you... She says, well, Papa read it to me. Oh, yes, he read it to me. It was beautiful. think we got the wrong book. I says, what do you mean? She says, I think we got Estelle's book, Estelle, my wife. And then I realized what had happened. At the very beginning of the book, like in most books, you were dedicated to somebody. So I dedicated my book to Estelle, my wife Estelle. And she thought that it was by
Estelle rather than dedicated to Estelle?
I'd written it to Estelle, and she read, it should have been to Mom.
Oh.
She didn't know the idea of printing a dedication, and that was sort of lovely, sad, but she was able to, without having been able to, I got her diploma, I still have it, from kindergarten. She went to kindergarten when she came over, and that was as far as she went, that she went right to work in a flag factory.
Wait, kindergarten, so she would have been, what, 6 years old?
She was 8 years old when she went to work in a flag factory as a finisher. And the finisher is, with a little scissor, you cut off all the little hanging threads. And when the Geary Society, who was looking for child labor laws not to be broken, when they heard that the Geary Society people were coming in, they put her in the bottom of a cloth bin and threw hundreds of flags on her and said, don't move until we tell you to. And she remembers being under those flags for half an hour sometimes while they went through the factory. And that's the kind of frightened little girl who grew up to be my mother, who always worried something was going to happen to us. We never left the house. She didn't say, be careful. Of what? Anything.
Well, that was the Jewish generation back then. That's the way parents and mothers were. They were not so far removed from unbelievably terrible things happening in Europe and America and, you know.
One of the things that my mother told me about, and her sister told me, her older sister said, when they were living in Romania, in Bucharest, there were the pogroms. There were these anti-Semites who would come through the villages, look for little kids, babies, take them out of cribs, pick them up by the legs and throw them against a wall. They killed babies that way. And my mother remembers when she was 2.5, 3 years old, being put in a cast iron oven that wasn't on, but they hid her in a cast iron oven. And she remembers looking through the thing and hearing the Cossacks, whatever they were called, coming through the town looking for babies. And she, very soon after that, they migrated to America. My mother was about 2 or 3 when they started to come over from Romania to Ellis Island.
I think it is one of the wonderful things is that you know these stories about your parents. And do you even know stories about your grandparents?
My father used to tell me stories about, I don't think I wrote about this, but my father was very proud of his father because my father was an inventor and had the steadiest hand I've ever seen. But he talked about his father. And this one story I remember telling me as a kid, I said, tell it again. I used to love this story. His father was he was a very religious man. My father wasn't religious. My father believed in God, but he never went to shul. But his father was religious with a long beard, and he said, but he had a very good reputation in town. Now, there was a little girl in town who had been walking around with a crochet needle in her hand. She fell, and it punctured her cheek.
I give up.
And the hook was right below her eye. And they took her to the doctor, and the doctor says, I'm not a surgeon. I can't possibly operate on this. And you couldn't pull it out, because if you pulled it out, the hook would rip the skin. So they said, Mr. Reiner, the jeweler, he's got the steadiest hands. Let's go to him. They went to my father told me, and they said, Mr. Reiner, we'd like you to take this hook. And he says, I can't do that. You know, I'm not allowed. He's will indemnify you. The doctor said, I'll take full responsibility. And my father told me, he said, his father looked at this thing, and he said, the hook is right below the eye. He says, if I go probing for it, he says, I can rip a lot of the muscle there. So he got a very sharp razor, and he made a crisscross right about where the hook might be, a cross. So he now had 4 flaps, he said. So he could open up the 4 flaps, and he found the hook and pulled the crocheting needle out, holding the hook and pulling it out the other way so it didn't rip any flesh. And he asked them to sew it up. He says, well, I don't do that. He says, you have a hit. And he actually sewed up the little girl, and she grew up to have very little scar there. And they always told the story that Mr. Reiner was the one who made this little scar for her. here that would have that saved her eye, actually.
And then, actually, this may be the first and only time in history when a cross did something good for the Jews.
Yes.
Usually that's not the case. We are talking with the delightful Carl Reiner, the legendary Carl Reiner. Now, you are 91, thank God, years old, with, you know, probably another 20, 30 years left. But I have to ask, like, are you, God willing, healthy? And also the fact that all these memories are coming to you. Are you fine with short-term memory as well? Are all your everything intact? How are you doing?
Well, my short-term, you know, I tell a joke about that. As a matter of fact, it might be even in the book. This is me talking. I say, I once said, you know, I think I'm starting to have problems with my short-term memory loss. You know, I think I'm beginning to have problems with my short-term memory loss. And that's exactly right. A few minutes ago, I was trying to remember the name of a particular songwriter, Leonard Cohen. I just thought of it now, and I couldn't think of it 10 minutes ago. Leonard Cohen is a wonderful songwriter who my daughter Annie, who sings like her mother, and that's another thing I'd love to brag about my children, but Leonard Cohen is a name I couldn't think about 15 minutes ago. It just came to me. That's what happens. I said that the brain is like a computer. When you get to be 90 years old, you put so much information into that brain. It's there someplace, but it's clogged. I said, when you ask a computer who wrote Hamlet, you have to wait a second before Shakespeare comes up. I says, wait a few seconds, and it'll bubble up. And it just bubbled up. Leonard Cohen's name just bubbled up. And I was talking about my daughter. When you ask me what am I most proud of, and most people ask me that because I've done a lot of things that I really, you know, from the Van Dyke Show to everything I've ever done, the happiest days of my life was those 5 years I did the Van Dyke Show
really?
In show business, yeah, the show business part of my life. Yeah, those 6 years, 5 years were the...
So not to interrupt, but those even trumped when you would go on to direct movies?
Yes, absolutely. Well, I love directing movies, and I love writing the movies I made. Writing is the number one thing that excites me. When there's an empty page, and you put down a line, I'm saying that's the, you know, and every writer has done that, from the guy who wrote the Bible. When you write something brilliant down, you say, where did that come from? And it came from the God within you. You got God inside your head who's helping you all the time.
Well,
but
yes.
But the proudest thing I was saying is the fact that when I wrote I Remember Me, I said, this is the best thing I've ever written. And I do believe it's so, because it encompasses everything I feel about everything. I was able to freely honestly talk about whatever was in my head. And these lovely stories come out, some funny, some sad. And I don't know if you read the end of it, but I read it when the book was in galleys. There was a woman's club called Women Who Write, about 60 or 70 women. And they asked me to read some of the... And I read the last chapter of the book called The End, which is when my dear wife passed away of 65 years. 65 years with the right woman is what I call that particular part of my life. And I read it to them, and somebody filmed it because they were filming my promotion to the book, and they filmed the audience, and you never saw women crying copiously. They were tearing and crying and blowing their noses in handkerchiefs because of that last two pages of an honest appraisal of what was going on as my wife was passing. And
did you cry? Did you get emotional when you were writing it? And do you even get emotional?
You cannot not feel as you're writing something. But there was also a kind of, you know, when somebody has to go because they were of an age. My wife was, when I met her, I was 20. She was 27, 28. She was always 8 years older than I. And when we got married, she was almost eight years older than I. So when she passed away, she was 94, and she was sick for the last year of her life and suffering a lot the last couple of days. And the last hours were really, really tough. And so all my children were there, and we were you know, urging her to let go. My son was saying it to her, Ma, you can go, you know. And because she was not reacting to anything, she just lay there quietly, hardly breathing. And we were all on the bed with her, and I'm telling now what happened. And the last half hour, we weren't even sure she was alive or hearing anything we said. We were telling her, you know, how much we loved her and how much she did meant to us as mother and wife. And there was some I got the idea that Estelle, in her 60th year, started becoming a jazz singer. And she, the last 30 years of her life, she sang in a club once a week, once a month. And wonderful 7 albums of jazz she turned out, a really great jazz. She was a great jazz singer in the Billie Holiday tradition. And I decided that while she was going, she had her music in her room, and I put her last album, Adult Songs for Children, where she sang these wonderful songs geared for children. She said these wonderful songs will disappear and kids will never know them, the songs of the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And there it was. I said, play it loud so she can hear her voice as she goes. And we played, I think it was, Hey, You're Adorable, Be You're So Kissable. Anyway, that was the song that was playing. And there was the hospice women in the room that were, you know, there to oversee the passing. And one of the hospice nurses said, what a lovely, sweet voice she has. Now, we weren't sure she was hearing us because she breathed like once every minute or two. There was a slight taking in of air. And I was lying right next to her looking for some indication that she could hear us or see us or understand what we're saying to her, but no, nothing. And the final minute, when that nurse said, what a lovely, sweet voice, my son Lucas went right up to his mother's face, and as loudly as he could, he says, Ma, the nurse said you have a lovely, sweet voice. And we would not have known she heard it, except the moment before she expired, she mouthed the words, thank you. We didn't hear it. She didn't aspirate them. The lips were formed to say, thank you. And we could see the U and the TH. And we all looked at each other. We could not believe that she'd been hearing for the last half hour everything that was said, but could not respond because she had no breath left in her. And so it was one of the saddest, sweetest endings I've ever heard, because she was with all her loved ones. She was able to, the day before, when she was still compos mentis, she talked to all the kids individually and apologized to one of them for not having been a better mother. And they all assured her that was she a great mother, but an inspirational mother. And so everything was, so the ending was a sweet, sad passing, but that's the way life should be. You should have a great life and pass as easily surrounded by your loved ones. You couldn't ask for anything better.
And you had mentioned that, you know, because she had been in pain and suffering for a while, there is a relief finally at the passing. But once she's gone, is it true that over the next year or so, the grief comes in waves? You feel fine for a day or a week, and it's okay. And then
there's never a day. It's been 4 or 5 years now, and there's never a day. I see her every moment of the day because my house is decorated by her. My wife was, as you read in the book, she was one of these women who could do everything. She was an artist. She was a decorator. She was a singer. She was a painter. She was there's nothing she couldn't do. She could cook. She could. So every part of the house, it reflects her. And so I once said that, Estelle, nobody is gone if you're alive. I'm alive, so Estelle is alive. She's in me. There's no question if she... When I was walking around the block the other day, I said, she's walking with me. When I sit in the car, driving my car, I have 7 of her albums. She sings. She sings songs to me. Last night, I was listening just a couple hours ago. I went to the store. I've grown accustomed to her face. She did a version of that that will melt you. She just sung so beautifully. So she's with me all the time. I say goodnight to her every night, and we go to before I go to bed, I say goodnight to her.
Now, did other folks that you've known over the years, your friends and fellow workers and people who have acted and worked with you in films, were they very helpful and commiserated, and did you get together with other people who had lost their spouses of 30, 40, 50 years, and kind of, did that help you get through it too?
It all helps. The only thing that helps, that really matters, is that you had a positive 65 years with somebody, a little bump or two along the way, but for the most part, it was 65 glorious years. And the only thing that really matters is that from those 65 years, we've spawned, as I put it this way, I said, Estelle raised three great kids and one great husband. And she really did, because being older than me, she informed everything I became. She was socially interested in everything, in civil rights and in the rights for race rights, people being equal. And everything I learned about the social world was from her. And we got three really extraordinary children. I mean, I mentioned my daughter just a moment ago. My daughter is one of these hyphenates where she's got a doctorate in philosophy. She's got a doctor of psychoanalysis. She's a painter. She's a poet. She writes children's books. And she sings like her mother. She sings in the same club her mother does, with the same voice and the same kind of brilliant musicality. And so that's Annie. And then I've got Robbie Reiner, who everybody knows about. He's now in New York doing another new movie with Diane Keaton and Michael Douglas, just starting it in a week. And he's the list of pictures he has directed, you know, they're iconic. I mean, from The Princess Bride to The American President to The Shawshank Redemption. I mean,
Spinal Tap, of course, also. Yes, I mean, wonderful, amazing. But did he ever come
to you? Wait, and then I have a young son who was born 13 years after the other ones. And there's a wonderful story in there when we told the children about their mother being pregnant when they were 11 and 13 years old, which is one of my favorite stories, and I'll tell it to you if you want.
Sure, please. This is you tell the kids we have a surprise coming for you.
Yeah, okay. First, I'll tell you about Lucas Now. Lucas Now is 50 years old and a world-renowned artist. When his mother was painting, she had an easel. When Lucas was sick, she put a little easel next to hers, and so he painted along with his mother. So he's got his mother's hand, the same brilliant mother's hand, and he's now got paintings all over in every gallery in Europe, and he just had a big show in Beverly Hills at Wilshire Boulevard last month. He's an extraordinary painter. He does trees, the most beautiful paintings of trees, large, small. He does etchings. Anyway, that's Lucas. But when the kids were 12 and 11, one day Estelle, who was now in menopause, and we were surprised that she could get pregnant, and we were so excited about the fact there was going to be another kid in the family, because we were very happy to be parents, and we decided to tell the kids about it, and we played it. They were sitting at the breakfast table, and we said, we have a little surprise for you. And they said, 20 questions. We give them 20 questions. And they started. Now, at the time, my daughter had a friend whose kid had a pony. His father bought her a pony. Robbie's friend's father had a pool table that his son wanted. And he had so the two things in their mind were a pool table and a pony. That's what they were thinking. When they asked the question, they said, is this something, surprise, something we'll like? We says, yes. Will we be able to have it in the house? Yes. Will I be able to play with it? Yes. Pool table. And we went on and on, and they were saying yes to everything. And finally, they said they know what it is. And one of them said, it's a pool table. And the other one says, no, it's a pony. And I said, no, you're both wrong. You're going to have a baby brother or sister. And with that, without saying anything, they slid off their chairs, I'll never forget it, and fell onto the floor and started to laugh hysterically. And I said, what the hell are they laughing at? They could not, they were both laughing at the same thing, and we didn't know what they were laughing at. They're pounding their fists on the ground, kicking their legs, and finally words came out. And the words that came out, Annie said, Mama's going to have a pony. And Bobby says, no, Mama's going to have a pool table. They were laughing that Mother was going to give birth to a pool table and a pony. And they both thought of it together without saying, and they fell on the floor. Well, long time. And of course, it was Lucas Reiner, and they were very. And Annie was like a second mother to him. She used to carry him around all the time.
And it's lovely that the family is still close. I mean, they all banded together when you lost Stella, a.k.a. Estelle. And you know, it's good that everybody loves each other and is friends and is Hamish. Not all families are like that, but it sounds like yours is.
No, our three children, they talk to each other all the time, and they make sure on each of their birthdays they go out and have dinner together. And they don't live far from each other. That's one of the lucky things I have here. Each one of them is no more than 20 minutes from my house. Usually kids go away and they go into other cities. And I'm very fortunate that I do see my kids very often.
Do you have great-grandchildren at this point?
What?
Do you have great-grandchildren yet?
No. The oldest one is Jake Reiner, and he's at Syracuse. He's a journalist, and he's the closest. He's not married yet, so we better not have any grandchildren.
We are, by the way, talking with the wonderful, the legendary Carl Reiner about his book, I Remember Me. And one of the things, some of the things that you remember in the book and that are so fun to read are the anecdotes about other legends in the business. Some of them nice, some of them not so nice. I love the story about your meeting Jack Benny in a commissary.
That was one of my favorite little accidents. When I was doing the Dick Van Dyke Show, there was a commissary on the Desilu lot, Desilu Coenga. Desi Arnaz and Lucille Ball owned the studio. And I came in for lunch in the little commissary, and sitting at the table was Jack Benny, whom I never met, but I love Jack Benny. Jack Benny, you know, was an icon to everybody. Radio, we never missed a Jack Benny show, and you know, he had a reputation of being on the air, of being the most miserly man in the world. If you saw a penny, he'd pick it up. And the biggest laugh ever in radio was Jack Benny playing this miserly man, being held up in an alley, and a guy says, a crook sticks a gun at him, and says, "Hey, you, give me your money or it's your money or your life." And no answer. "You see, hear what I said? It's your money or your life." And the answer was, I'm thinking. Those two lines got the biggest laugh in radio in the history of radio. So that is in prelude to what I was about to tell you. I walked in here, and Jack Benny's sitting at the table, and he sees me. He says, Carl, come over. We never met, but he watched the shows, and he was very nice about sending notes about liking the show. He says, sit down. He was very anxious to talk to somebody, and he said, and without stopping to say anything like, "We want anything to eat," he says, "I've got to tell you something. Something just happened to me. It's so listen to this." He says, "I'm coming from the Burbank airport." He says, and "on a plane. I'm on a little plane, and I have to go to the bathroom so badly." And I said, "Can I use the commode here?" He says, "No, it'll be very uncomfortable." He says, "We're going to land in about a minute." He says, "We'll put down, and you'll go to the Burbank airport. They have a toilet there. You'll use that. You'll be much more comfortable." He said, "I ran off the plane, and I ran to the toilet, and there it was." He said, "I looked at it. It was a pay toilet. A dime. You had to put a dime in to get into the toilet. I reached in my pocket. I had 5 pennies, a nickel, and a quarter. No dime." He said, "I couldn't get in. There was nobody around to get change." He says, "So I dropped to the floor, and I slid." It was a tiny little cubicle. "I slid under the door, went and did my business, and I just about made it," he said. "And I was so pleased that nothing happened." He said, "Now, how do I get out of here? The door is locked from the inside. You can't open." He said, "I couldn't get on the ground to get out because it was too small to sit down." He said, "I'll climb over the top." So he's climbing over the top of the door, and he's got one leg over, and just as he's up there, 3 people come into the restroom. They look up, and one guy says, "Jack Benny, Mr. Benny, it's only a dime." And he thought that was
it's a wonderful attribution to what people thought his real character was.
It had just happened, and he couldn't wait to tell me the story. That was what tickled me so much. He couldn't wait. He laughed as he told it. And, of course, he was the most generous man in the world. He helped everybody. Every vaudevillian who ever needed a hand, he would help.
And I may be misremembering this. Was he going to be in the movie Oh God, but he wasn't well enough, and that's when George Burns got it? Was that the, was it him?
No, I don't know. He was one of the people thought, but George Burns was the first choice because he had about him, you know, George Burns did a television show with his wife, but at the beginning of the show, he would talk to the audience and tell them what was going on inside the house. He was like omnipresent. And I said, that's the kind of a God it should be. He should look like a simple man like George Burns. So George was my first choice to play the part.
And he was, of course, superb. And I think you write in the book that he had a terrific work ethic. He was always on time. There was
He learned the whole script. So I could, any day's work, if I wanted to move a scene out, he knew all the lines. He knew every line and every scene. He learned the whole script. And he gave me one of the funniest things I've ever heard. Is this in the book? I think it is. When he said, I went, the last day, I wanted to say goodbye, he's in his trailer, and I said, I was 60 at the time, he's 80, and I said, George, I said, you know, you always talk about show business, you never talk about your kids, he's not a kid, they're nice people, it's not boring, you know, not to talk about. I said, but you know, there's one thing I'd like to ask you, if you don't mind. He said, I always see you on the, you have two or three lovely girls on your arm when you're going out to dinner. And I said, I'm just interested in knowing sexually what I have to look forward to when I get to be 80. I was 60 then. And he says, oh, yeah, you want to know? He says, and this is what he told me. He says, did you ever try to put an oyster into a slot machine?
God.
That was his advice.
And what is it true? I mean,
he said it.
No, I know he said it, but have you just, now that when you were in your 80s and 70s?
Oh, no, 80s I was all right, but, you know, he was, for some reason, he was worn out. So I lasted until my 90s, but I don't think about that anymore.
Really, it does, well, of course, now that you've, you know, you are a widow person, but how do I even put this? Were you still, did you have Vim, Vigor, and Viagra in your early 80s?
No, I never, until when my wife passed, we were having an active life until in the mid, right through the middle 80s.
Oh, well, mid-mazel, that is wonderful to hear. Now, speaking of things naughty and sort of sexual, you have a story that's, well, not so nice about the actress Shelley Winters in there, about her behavior on set.
Oh, well, Shelley Winters was a pain in the ass. She was an award-winning actress, and maybe one of the great actresses in the world, and also a very sexual person. She had affairs with, you know, she wasn't shy about them, with some of the handsomest men in Hollywood, and married a couple of them, like Vittorio Gassman, I think she was married to. But, the story I told is the last day of the show, the last week of shooting of Etta Laughing, the film, I needed a scene in the, I needed something from her. She was going to be sitting in the audience with David Opatashu, and they were going to watch the opening of the theater curtain. The curtain was going to go up, and Jose Ferrer was going to walk upon the stage. All I needed from them was looking at the stage and watch the curtain. No lines, just to watch the light change on them. You see that it's dark, and when the curtain goes up, the light comes on them, and they watch Jose Ferrer cross the stage. Well, I told Jose and David that I need this before lunch so we can move, we can get the camera on stage after that, and I'm going to get the camera in the theater and go up on differently, you know, change the angle. And she said, where's Jose? I said, well, Jose isn't here, but I'll wear his clothes and I'll walk across the stage. I said, I could, you know, I could have done this part if Jose didn't want to do it. And she said, but you're not Jose. I said, I know, but I will be doing, all I want you to is watch, give me your eye line and so we can see your eye moving, watching me cross. She said, well, I don't work that way. I said, well, Shelley, this is the only way I work. I got 32 days to finish this picture, and I have to do it. And she said, well, I don't do it. And she left. She left the theater. She got up and walked out. And I was stuck. And I said, oh, my God. And now she's angry at me. And so we had to get that shot, and after lunch, she's not there. She won't come to the set. And because I insulted her, because I said, I don't work that. Well, it's my show. Anyway, Joe Stein, who was the co-author and co-producer, I sent him to her trailer. I said, get her out. I got to get her in here. And she said, she won't come. She won't come. And I said, well, and then I had an idea. I said, well, tell her to listen to what I'm going to tell the cast and crew about why we're not moving forward. And I could see from the corner of my eye that she was way on the far side of the stage listening to. She was peeking around.
Uh-huh.
Wanted to hear what I had to say. And I said, I said, ladies and gentlemen, it seems we're not going to be able to continue because, I said, it's my fault. I take full responsibility. I said, Shelley Winters, as we know, is a very great actress and a very sensual, wonderful woman. And when I cast her for this part, one of the promises I made her, and we know that she, you know, she is a beautiful, sensual woman. The promise I made her is that I would have sex with her anytime she wanted, day or night. Whenever she felt the urge, I'm her man. And I told her that, and she was very happy with that.
Oh, she was? Okay.
And then I went home and I told my wife, I said, you know, to get this picture done, I have to have sex with Shelley anytime she wants. And my wife said, I forbid it. I will not allow that. So I said, now I told my wife, and she says, I can't do it. But I'm telling you, folks, even though my wife says I can't, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. Anytime Shelley wants to have sex, I'm her man. And that's what I'm proposing, but it's too late now. And, of course, she started to laugh and came on stage.
Why do... Can you... Having worked with so many actors and performers and volatile personalities over the years, why do actors behave like that? What gets into them that they feel...
Very few do behave like that. I haven't had much trouble. I worked with Bette Midler, had no trouble with her. I've worked with a lot of stars. No, that was one of the few people that... But for the rest of the show, she was fine.
But they just need to be diva-ish for an afternoon. I mean, they need to pull Raquel Welch. There was a horrible story about her with Merchant Ivory years ago that I've never forgiven her for after reading that about humiliating them. There's just something gets into people when they get famous sometimes. But I guess you would say that the vast majority that you have worked with are...
The vast majority of us, the really big stars are really big people. Then there are people who are very insecure, and their insecurity shows in the fact that they get obstreperous. They're really afraid of the position they hold, and they do anything to try to destroy themselves.
Now, and it's funny that we're talking about this, because someone that... I was interviewing Charles Grodin just the other day, a wonderful actor.
Was he a funny guy?
And he was saying that one person that he has not been very comfortable with was, of all people, Mel Brooks. Because the first time he was working with Mel Brooks, Brooks was just screaming at him for no reason, first time he met him. And that apparently Brooks has done this at other points, and he is apparently a volatile fella. What is the chemistry that you have with Mel Brooks, who can be, I guess, amazingly funny and hilarious and wonderful most of the time, and other times you don't know what the hell you're getting into?
Well, you know, Mel Brooks has never yelled at me, because when I met Mel Brooks, he was not yet formed. He was 21, 22 years old, but he was terribly, terribly funny. I'd write about how he did a Jewish pirate complaining. That's the first time I saw him. I didn't know who he was. It was in Max Liebman's office. Sid Caesar was there. He stood up and he said, you know how difficult it is to set sail this day, what they're charging for sailcloth, $3.24 an hour, 24 cents a yard. He's, I can't afford to pillage and rape anymore. That's the first time I heard him. And the next day I came in, I had seen this show called We the People Speak, where they recreate the news. And I said, hey, that's a good one to do a takeoff on, you know, recreating the news. And I said, there's a man who was actually in Stalin's toilet, and he heard Stalin say, going to blow up the world Thursday. And I brought it in, and they said, no. And I turned to Mel, and I said, here's a man who was at the scene of the crucifixion 2,000 years ago. And started, he said, oh, boy. And then started the beginning of the 2,000-year-old man. For the next 10 years, years, from 1950 to 1960, anytime there was a lull in the office or at parties, people say, get up, fellas. So Mel became an entity because of the fact that we became the 2,000-year-old man. In 1960, 10 years after we'd been doing it at parties for years, always ad-lib. He never knew what I was going to ask him. And so that's the relationship we have. I invented the 2,000-year-old man, and Mel took the 2,000-year-old man and made him the sage of the world. But he never could get stuck. You couldn't stick him with a question. The tougher the question, the funnier the answer. And so it informed who Mel became. And from then on, he went upward and faster than anybody. I mean, the amount of material he has been created and written and directed is, you know, is immense.
And for a lot of people of my generation and my ilk, the producers, is with all due respect to your movies, I still think it's the funniest movie ever made. But one of the funniest stories in your book about Mel Brooks is actually not on a film thing, but in a party that you were having. This I think is just, and you even have a picture of this. And I think this just says everything about the way he could be at his best. You were having a dinner party in a very crowded place.
What was that one about now? Which one are you talking about?
Well, he was, I don't want to give it away because I want you to tell it, but there are all these people gathered and everything. He comes in with a cup of tea, and for some reason, because there was no place for him at the table, he found another place to sit.
Oh, yes. No, that was in my house in the south of France. Yeah, we had a very lovely little house in the south of France with sort of a sculpted living room. In other words, the banquettes were made of white plaster, and we had pillows on it. And the fireplace was a little cutout of white plaster, and it was. And so our friends were there, and we had about six or seven friends, and Mel was visiting at that point. And so every friend took a piece, a chair, or part of the couch to sit on. There was no place for Mel to sit. Mel took a little stool,
right,
placed it in the fireplace. He took a cup of coffee with him, and he went into the fireplace, sat in the fireplace. So only he was from the chest up. You couldn't see him. His head was up in the flue, and the coffee was in his lap. Every once in a while, the coffee would go out of frame, and he would take a sip, and he kept the conversation, Mel, from the fireplace. And that was Mel being Mel. But I thought, yeah, there was many, many different crazinesses that Mel invented and went through that I write about in the book.
And do you still keep in contact? Are you still close friends?
Well, he comes over every night. I'm looking at the seat. He's 2 feet away. He usually sits there. He'll be here tonight. We're having lunch. He comes over at least six nights a week, sometimes seven.
Now, did you, I guess I'm going to reverse the question that I asked you a few minutes ago. Did you help him through, and how did you help him through when Anne Bancroft passed? Because they were so close.
Oh, well, the thing that was lovely about it is that Anne Bancroft and Estelle Reiner were very close, dear friends. Anne loved Estelle a lot because Estelle was a very wise person, and they could discuss things that needed discussing. And so we spent a lot of time together. And when Estelle sang, Mel and Annie were in every one of her performances for years and years. And we were very, very close. And when Anne, Mel, and Estelle left, we commiserated with each other. We still do. We still talk about them, you know. Every once in a while, something will come up and say, oh, we wish they could be here to see that.
That's what it is. By the way, we just have a few more minutes with the amazing and delightful Carl Reiner. Everybody, of course, get I Remember Me, his new book of anecdotes. Can I ask, are you generally only writing now, or are you still, you're appearing locally and reading from the book, but are you working on any projects, any screenplays, are you acting still?
No, I once in a while I'll do. I did a couple of Hot in Cleveland's. I don't know if I'll be doing much more acting. I've been asked to do a couple of things. I might, but mainly I'm writing, and that's the thing that really occupies my time. I write and tweet. I like to tweet a lot too. I send out tweets, and But the writing is what I'm doing right now, and promoting I Remember Me, which is a labor of love. I love the fact that, by the way, I Remember Me is also an iBook and an e-book. I don't know what that means, but it means something to people. It's on a Kindle. You can get it on a Kindle. And there's an e-book that has all kinds of musical things on it. And people who know what e-books will know. And that's available, too, to wherever you get them.
And have you...
Whoever sells these things.
Have you done an audio book of it? Are you going to do that, where people can hear you read the entire book?
Yes, I have. There is me reading the book. There is a disc of my reading the book. Yes, absolutely.
Because there are so many delightful and fun and poignant stories in the book. I even hate to let you go, but I have to hear one or two more. Especially, there's an actor that we might not remember, but he was on Broadway named David Burns. And he seems like a hell of a character that you're talking about there. And I do love that story, the filthy story of him at Sarah Siddons Hall. Would you share that one?
Yes. David Burns was a well-known actor on Broadway. He played the original peddler in Oklahoma, and he did an awful lot of stuff on Broadway. I did two shows with him, and I think we're doing the show Alive and Kicking, and a girl named Lenore Lonergan was in it, a very lovely actress. And there was a club called the Sarah Siddons Club. I think it was in Boston, wasn't it?
Might be. That I do not recall.
Yeah, I think it was in Boston, and we're out of town, and it's a very staid club, theatrical club, turn of the century. It was very staid, and all the very old people in it, they were all either connected with the theater or had somebody connected with the theater, and they invited, you could never go there for lunch unless you were invited, so they invited Lenore Lonergan, and she invited Davy Burns and myself. Davy Burns had the foulest mouth in showbiz. He was funny. He was funnier than he was foul, and that's the quotient. If a guy is funnier than he's dirty, I accept him. If he's dirtier than he's and not as funny, I don't listen to him.
Right,
but
yes.
It was funny. Anyway, we're having lunch in this quiet place. It's so quiet you could hear a pin drop, and he says to Lenore, he says quietly to her, he's Lenore, you know what I'd like to do after lunch? I'd like to go upstairs with you and have you sit on my face for half an hour. And she says, Davy, you're disgusting. He stands up and he yells at the top of his lung, I'm disgusting? I'm disgusting? You're sitting on my face and you call me disgusting? He throws his napkin on her lap and leaves. And everybody, nobody knows where to look. The women are nonplussed. Nobody says a word, and we quietly just sneak out of there. And I don't know what was said after we left, but I'm sure it wasn't complimentary.
But did you explode with laughter in the parking lot afterwards?
I mean, I exploded then. I mean, I was stifling my laugh. I was hysterical.
That's a beautiful, I mean, to have the guts to do something like that.
I know. He once did something which you as a rabbi would be very upset about, but he did it on 6, I remember exactly where it was, 48th Street and Broadway. And it has to do with religion, and as I've said in the book that I am an
agnostic. You said
I'm an atheist. No, I.
Oh, you're the atheist. The other person was the agnostic. So you do not believe in the existence of God.
Yeah, no, I believe that we are God. I have a whole theory that we are God. Every man in him, every person has God in him.
If I am God, the world is in big, big trouble. Let me tell you something.
Well, every good thought. You see, God is in. The smartest things ever said that were put in the Bible were said by a man. God didn't write the Bible. It was a man who wrote the Bible. And when Moses went up to the mountainside, Moses, one of the smartest men that lived at that time, there's always been a smart man. The smartest man who lived in the caveman time was the guy who figured out, hey, you know something? Sex and birth have something to do with each other. You know, the Neanderthals didn't know that the sexual act had anything to do with the birth of a child, because it was 9 months later. They didn't connect the two until one smart guy did it. And it's the same thing with the Bible. There was a smart guy named Moses, went up to the mountainside. He had these wonderful ideas, some wonderful, some not so good. you know, stone a man who adulterizes and kill a woman who adulterizes. That's not a very good idea.
Not very
but
nice
he did have a couple ideas, honor thy parents, Aaron's parents. But when he was putting those down, I do think synchronistically, it happens all the time. You hear a door slam and you have a thought and you say, look at that, happened at the same time. I think there was a bolt of lightning that hit when he was having these great thoughts. If he came down from the mountain and said, look at these wonderful ideas I had, they would say, who are you? If he said, but this came from another source, this came when the lightning hit, God said, and they listened to it. They would not have listened to a man. And man has always made the laws. It was man who wrote the Bible. There wasn't anybody in heaven writing a Bible and sending it down. That was man doing it. Man has been very smart for a very long time. He wrote some brilliant things in the Bible and some terrible things, which nobody notices those parts of the Bible. They use the part of the Bible. We hold the Bible up and say, pray to this. Don't pray to the things that are wrong in the Bible. But from that time on, a lot of things have been discovered. They discovered germs. They discovered penicillin. They discovered how to go to the moon. Man did that. The God in man, the brilliance in man, that is where God is. He exists in everybody's head.
But, and you know, as a rabbi, I kind of agree with all that. But the one question that always would nag me is, okay, what? How do you explain not inventing penicillin, but where mold came from originally? How do you explain the sky? How do you explain a tree?
I mean, as a matter of fact, I have a young nephew who's a scientist who was just a... when Einstein died, he didn't know that, he didn't believe that his theory could be right, that the theory of relativity, the other theory, there was another theory, relativity plus the expansion of the universe. He didn't know, and my nephew, who was a genius scientist, discovered, and he discovered only because the Hubble telescope and they could look into space and see that something existed 170 billion years ago. It is no longer there. It's a black hole, but it did exist. And man started, the whole universe started from a bit of amino acid that became people, goats, ants, fleas, moths. All of these things started because of an accident that happened in the galaxy. And we don't know. So we don't know how, we never knew how it happened. So you say, well, somebody did it.
Right.
And God is the guy who gets credit or blame for it. And
yeah, I mean, somebody had to make the amino acid. I mean, had to start the study.
By the way, one of the reasons I'm an atheist, and this you may understand, God is all-powerful. You pray to him. During the Holocaust, 16 million Jews and 100 million other people died, and all of those people, I'm sure a good many of them, were religious, saying, please, God, stop this from happening. What was he doing if he was there? Was he making flowers? Was he making bugs? What was he doing? Was he looking down and saying, my God, I can't do nothing about this? You know, I had a friend who wrote a wonderful thing called God Almighty, where God... this is a guy named Tony Webster. By the way, he was a writer who once came to me and wanted, he was complaining. I said, you never can complain. A writer can't complain. Actors can complain. I said, you're a writer here. And I said, I owe you one play. And signed it. And Tony signed it. 6 months later, he came back and he says, give me back my IOU. He wrote a thing called God Almighty. And in one of the most brilliant things I've ever read. But he had God up in heaven, and God was meeting man, and man said to God, hello, you know, I'm made in your image, and God said, I don't remember you. He says, yes, I'm man, you made me in your image. And God says, I remember making the ant because he can carry something 18,000 times his weight, and I remember the flowers, they smell good, and I don't remember you. What do you do? And you know what man did?
What?
He did a soft shoe across the stage. He danced a soft shoe across the stage. And you know what? The brilliance of that is the most graceful thing man does. There isn't a person in the world who sees a man or a woman doing a soft shoe that doesn't melt or smile and say, "Oh." And if you wanted to show an alien the grace of human being, let him watch Fred Astaire or Gene Kelly do shoe, and you'll know what charm and grace is. And he does a soft shoe, and God watches him. And at the end of it, God says to man, can you teach me that? That was the line. And then God is left alone on stage. And this was Tony Webster's ending of the first act. God is left alone on stage. He looks out. He sees rape. He sees pillage. He sees wars. He sees thunderstorms. He sees volcanoes erupting. And he's standing in the middle of the stage. And as the lights dim on him, he points his arms. He reaches skyward. God does.
Yes.
And you realize what he's doing. He's praying for another God, for a God to help him.
Wow.
That's what man has done. Man has done that. When we had the Holocaust and he wasn't there, what was God doing? He was probably looking up and saying, help these people.
Maybe, but again, you know, we have the image where we're humanizing God and hoping that he is benevolent, but your playwright friend also had the idea of, you know, he did what he did. He's not benevolent, he's not malevolent. He created it, he's watching, he doesn't do. I mean, you could even say, let's say about your marriage to Estelle, right? You had all these wonderful, wonderful years, so you can thank God for the joy of all that, and or the last few years and the last few months, she was in terrible pain and agony, you know, until she finally passed. And you can say, oh, God, why did you do that to her?
Oh, no, I don't blame God for anything. I blame myself I give myself credit or blame for anything good. My wife was an atheist. I was an atheist. We loved each other, and we didn't pray to anything but each other's health. We had a great, 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 great time, and I don't blame anything, and you take credit and you take blame for the good and bad in you. You don't blame it and say, oh, God did look down on me wrong. No, I don't blame God. I will not be shaken from that no matter what. And I'm 91 years old, and I have the great life to prove it. I have a life that I could not, if I taken tomorrow, it's been a wonderful life. I have 5 grandchildren, 3 great kids, I had a great marriage. He left me my brain. If there is a God, my brain is still operating.
Oh, it obviously is. It's so great to hear you so incredibly, like I could be talking to a 30-year-old right now. I mean, it's no difference. You've just been absolutely wonderful. And the last thing that I think that we want to leave our listeners with is kind of cute story about Estelle and her final wishes, which you sort of have not followed, where she wanted to be finally interred.
Oh, yeah. Well, Estelle didn't. No, this is a true story. We decided that both of us would be cremated, the Neptune Society. There was a funny story that Estelle in the last year was bedridden, but she had all her senses about her. We had friends up there for dinner. We had little tables, and she had a lot of life up, and, you know, she had other things wrong beside, you know, her heart. But when she was, she also loved catalogs. She used to buy a lot of stuff out of catalogs for Christmas presents for the kids and Hanukkah presents. And so there was a lot of that going on. And after she passed, there were packages that always kept coming because she had ordered some. And one day a package came, and our housekeeper said, oh, another package for Estelle. And I said, that's not a package for Estelle. That is Estelle. It was the Neptune Society ashes that they, I noticed the Neptune Society is what these, who cremated her. And I told my children, I said, now she's in a box upstairs sitting, that box of ashes is sitting on her stool that she sat on when she sang at the clubs. There's a microphone nearby. It's all, they're all set up the way she used to rehearse upstairs. And that's where she sits with a little tablecloth over the box. And I told the kids, when I go, I said, I want to be cremated, and I want my ashes mixed with Estelle's ashes, and put in a little miracle grow, and stick it out in the back where the tomatoes grow. We'll have a tomato patch where Estelle and I are in a tomato patch together for eternity.
Those would be the most delicious and hilarious tomatoes ever, ever grown,
yes.
I have to say. Carl Reiner, what can I say, an honor a joy, a delight talking to you. If you want to read some of the stories he's been saying and so, so many more, please go get his book. What is the publisher? Please remind us of I Remember Me. Who publishes the book?
Oh, okay. Go to Amazon. They'll tell you.
Okay, you'll find it. You'll find it. Carl Reiner, I can only wish you, you know, many more years. Yes, many more years.
Thank you
being
so much.
Health and mentally well and just more joy from your family, from your work, from your writing, and I thank you tremendously for being in the neighborhood.
Thank you so much.